fair and equitable amount to award because they have experience. I don't have any problem with that. It would get rid of a lot of the costliness that, that Mr. Block was talking about for most of these claims. I would like to talk to you a little bit about some of the particular provisions in here very briefly. Punitive damages, I would like the insurance industry to tell us how many verdicts there have been in Alaska for punitive damages. Have there been more than two or three? I'm not aware. Punitive damages are very, very rarely awarded. Secondly, punitive damages, the insurance companies, I'm sure that Mr. Block can tell you that his insurance company probably has exclusion in their policy for punitive damages. Most policies do not cover punitive damages. Myself, I have never covered one dime for punitive damages. I would guess that 99% of lawyers in this community have never recovered one dime for punitive damages. Periodic payments, I think there was some statement earlier today that periodic payments would include inflation. I'm sure that most of you realize that if somebody's earning $20,000 in 1986 with inflation, they're probably going to be earning something like $180,000 40 years from now. It's a startling fact that if you look back over what's happened to our economy in the last 40 years, it's shocking what some people are earning today. If inflation is built in, this periodic payments thing is not going to save the insurance companies that much money. What it is going to do is it's going to force trials, because if I'm representing somebody that is who is not married, under this periodic payment plan, a quadriplegic's lifespan is reduced significantly. And let's say we have somebody that's horribly injured, is on a breathing apparatus because they have such a horrible injury. An insurance company is simply not going to pay that claim. They're going to try the case, get a verdict, get the judge to set this periodic payment plan, and hope that person died, because as soon as they die, those payments stop. Now, whether that's right or wrong, I'm not going to say. All I'm going to say is this periodic payment plan is going to force a lot more cases to go to trial, because the incentive would be to try cases that otherwise might settle. A lot of cases are resolved by periodic payments in settlements now, but under this thing, under this portion of it, periodic payments would only be mandated if you tried the case. They would not be mandated if you settled the case. So, for those people that did want to have a lump sum settlement because they had an idea that they wanted to start a new business, if they'd been injured, they wanted to start something that they'd never done before, they would probably say, I'm going to settle this case. I cannot go to trial and get stuck with this periodic payment plan because it does not fulfill my particular needs. So, periodic payment plan is something that is going to cut across what we try to do, which is resolve claims short of trial. The court system is going to get stuck with a lot more trials if there is a periodic payment plan mandated for verdicts over verification of claims. Let's have verification of claims and verification of defenses. What's wrong with verification of defenses? This is a legitimate defense. Collateral benefits. There's no such thing as a double recovery. Whether it's Blue Cross, or workers' comp, or any other third-party payment plan, they are reimbursed out of the settlement or out of the verdict. And if they're not reimbursed, what's Blue Cross going to do? They're simply going to raise their rates. Or what's the other healthcare providers that are cut out under this collateral benefits? I mean, it's kind of like you're giving the wrongdoer a windfall and making Blue Cross or some other health entity pay for it, something that they had no responsibility for. So if you're giving something to a liability insurance company and taking it away from some other entity or some other part of the insurance industry. I won't talk to you about contingency agreements, except I wonder if the insurance industry is so concerned about fees. I don't see anything here about limiting defense attorneys' fees. Disability, or the minority thing about no recovery for people without dependents. I mean, I just hope you realize what the public policy there is saying, and that is that if a busload of children are run down and killed, there's no recovery for that, no liability at all. I mean, the case would be dismissed. Now, whether you set it at $2,000, $10,000, $25,000, where you do, mean, to me, to say that a child's life is worth nothing is not good public policy. And I don't see how anybody can say with a straight face that that is good public policy, that you can kill children and not be held accountable for it at all. Lastly, on related to attorney's fees, something that, a lot of people don't realize is that related to attorney's fees works both ways. Sometimes when I'm representing somebody that I think wants too much for a claim, I will tell them, look, you realize that if we go to trial, if you turn down the settlement offer and we go to trial and we lose, you are going to be responsible for paying the other side's attorney's fees, a portion of their attorney's fees. And once the person realizes, the claimant realizes, that they have some exposure, it's not just an all-win situation, they can lose, then they become a little bit more rational about what the risks are. So, related to attorney's fees is something that, to a large extent, benefits plaintiffs, benefits defendants, because it does work as somewhat of a hammer over the plaintiff to make sure that they're right about turning down any settlement offer going to trial. Also, in every policy I've ever seen, related to attorney's fees coverage costs about $3 a year for the premium, so we're not talking about a substantial increase in premiums. I would agree with the previous speaker that this system has been in effect for a long time, and if you want to make some substantial changes in the civil justice system, you have to realize it's not something that's a quick fix. And if the insurance industry can come in and say, look, if we pass all these things, these insurance rates are going to drop, everything's going to be fine, we'll never have any problems again, that's one thing. But I don't think they can tell you that. I think that the civil justice system may need some improvements. I think the arbitration for $50,000 claims and less is a good idea. And I would agree with the previous speaker that it's something that should be looked at over the interim, carefully by people that are experienced in the system, by input from judges, input from litigators, input from the insurance industry, input from people that have been injured, and all sources. But there's no fast and easy solution, and I think it merits a careful scrutiny.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Diane Gale. Your rights to justice are being tampered with. In response to the non-economic damage
block your 5-year-old son? How can you legislate the monetary value of my child's life? How can you legislate the monetary value on my health condition when physicians are out the wrong system and I am left with a disease too? How can you legislate my husband's and my dreams after successfully raising an only cocoa when she becomes a victim of societal economy? Do you think $250,000 could replace my child? In response to joint and several liability issues, municipalities hide behind municipal immunity when manhole cover is left open and your wife falls into it, injuring her for life, and you are left to care for your 3 children and her for the rest of her life. According to one fortune cookie proverb, society creates crime and criminal intent, which victims of society pays the price. These societal inflicted crimes create a long-term care situation and dilemma for families and society as a whole. When you are a victim as a result of the action of another person's negligence, or when you have become your own victim, you are severely injured. The bottom line is you are still going to require a lifetime of care. As long as we value our motorized way of life and as a society, do not apply and do not mix alcohol, drugs, and driving at the same time messages, we are going to continue to have deaths and injuries. In the state of Washington, we have at least 300 fatalities and over 12,000 serious injury accidents per year as a result of alcohol and drug-related crashes. We have around 4,500 cases of kidney disease. Nationally, we have 26,000 alcohol drug-related crashes. Many victims feel this is a societal problem, and it's up to society to ensure that its citizens are afforded the type of health care and daily living they will need for the rest of their lives. Large settlements of 1 million-plus may seem astronomical to the uninformed and naive, but the segment of society we have to plan for and provide for 24-hour day nursing care for their loved ones for a 50 or 60-year period they pay for a temporary medical bill and make a cost that is realistic and proportional to the economic and emotional loss of victims and families involved in this unfortunate situation. In response to the pain, suffering, and grief issues, surviving victims include family members, primary and secondary drug riding crashes suffer serious physical, psychological, and financial damage as a result of their victimization. Far too often, the financial burden involved in these cases is overwhelming. They're telling so much that state agencies can be helping to improve the cost of their victims until a case finally goes to trial. It is clear in Julie's case that both the municipality and drunk driver were at fault. Julie is some like on her first. If it turns out that the drunk driver campaign is worth the final award, cost of life and time care will go unpaid. For society through Medicaid, you will have to bear the financial burden. Once again, the wrongdoer has shifted the burden of responsibility onto the victim or onto society as a whole. To illustrate the financial costs involved with a devastating accident such as Julie's, in the first 3.5 months, Julie's hospital and medical bills totaled over $100,000. As of November 30th, 1985, Medicaid had paid out over $192,000 for Julie's medical care alone. This does not include over $3,000 we paid out of our own personal funds to transfer her across the United States. Julie was hospitalized for over a year and was in a coma for at least 6 months. Unfortunately, her experience is no longer any victims. I am against mandatory periodic payments since economically this penalizes victims and lets the wrongdoer pay less than his or her fair share. Understand what future dollars will buy and inflation is sometimes easier to go back 15 years to 1935 when cotton was only 5 cents a cup and 1935 brand new Ford cost $1,200. If the Ford awards $250,000, if you divide it over a 4-year period, the victim will only receive $6,250 per year. In the 40th year, it will cost you $31,000 and secure the same goods and services that your $6,000 purchased. And our current award arrangement for recipients allows to invest a total amount, thus providing some protection against inflation, and simultaneously offsetting the future decline in dollars. The insurance companies would love it if necessary for a periodic payment scheme or institute, since it would allow them and the wrongdoer rather than the victim to have the use of the money in the meantime. Washington State has established resource to analyze this situation in depth and make recommendations. I suggest the state of Alaska be the same before making such drastic change to the tort system. It must gather information and review the many factors involved, including insurance company profits and loss. I can only hope that legislators do not rush in where more cautious agents, From what I read, the insurance industry has faced a challenge by overdue cancellation of policies. Without notice, as well as doubling, tripling, and increasing some rates by 20-fold. I support the Alaska Academy trial order to be on the bill now to be considered prior to the meeting.
Thank you very much, Ms. James. Dave, ready?
An opportunity to speak to some of these issues again that were raised.
Yes, there will. As soon as Mr. Frazier is done, I'm going to have a short coffee break, and we'll begin asking questions. And you'll have a chance to rebut some of the statements.
Hired one of the most renowned physician risk consultants in the
exclusively with physician hospital operated medical liability companies. Our actuary continually monitors Michael's claims experience, compares it to what's happening elsewhere in the United States, and calculates rates that are in conformance with legislative mandate in 1976. They're fair, they're adequate, they're not excessive. Every step of our 10-year existence has been followed closely by the Division of Insurance. Often the director has personally monitored our committee and board sessions. The director has reviewed and approved every rate and policy filing since our inception. I believe that Michael has done the right things and has fulfilled his mandate to the Alaska public. Why then are we back again telling you this story? It is because the legislature did only part of its job in 1976. And until the job is completed, the crisis will continue, I believe. There was a consortium committee to study the malpractice issue in 1976 set up by the governor. I believe that the public has already done their work in this regard and made recommendations. Those recommendations are very similar to the legislation that's proposed now. And I think that if board met again, they would probably come up with the same recommendations that they did in 1975-76. I think we're back to tell you that even though we believe that we did everything right, Mike's claims experience is no different than the rest of the hospital physician insurance companies in the United States. To offset expenses this year, our average rate increase is to provide $1 million policies with 150%. We continue to spend most of our revenue on legal expenses. It is not uncommon for us to spend $100,000 before the aggrieved patient receives 1 cent. The system is just not efficient. It doesn't work like Aetna or Blue Cross coverage, nor does it operate like our excellent workers' compensation system. These programs return 90 cents on the dollar. We are lucky if we can return 40 cents on the dollar to the patient. There is something wrong with this system. We are doing more dancing around the legal floor than we are doing business for Alaskans whom we are supposed to be serving. So this legislature has the opportunity of completing the job by enacting provisions of Senate Bill 337 and House Bill 532. These are good bills. They protect the interests of the majority of the people, and they are politically positive in nature. Non-enactment protects the status quo, protects special interest groups, economic windfalls, complaints of attorneys, and the eventual restriction of medical services to the general public. If the Senate and House do not act on these bills, I predict the following. Within 24 months, Michael will be the only insurance company writing physicians and hospitals in the state of Alaska. The Medical Indemnity Exchange Corporation of California and other companies will have completely pulled out. Michael's premiums will have again doubled. Our policy limits will probably not exceed $500,000. And our reinsurers will have discontinued support for the Alaska insurance companies. Michael will be pressured to underwriting all medical practitioners who apply. If that happens, our inability to accept or reject applications will have an adverse effect on our claims experience. Finally, Michael will have no alternative but to solicit the state for more funds.
Harry Schoenberg from the municipality of Anchorage is asked to testify from the municipality position and can. We'll allow him 5 minutes. Also, I've been asked to request that the witnesses speak as directly into the microphone as possible, both of them.
Good morning. I'm Harry Schoenberg, risk manager for the municipality of Anchorage. As perhaps many of you might have read, the municipality is probably have the greatest concern of all when it comes to the purchase of insurance. This, of course, is because of the services offered to the public. Cities nationwide are cutting back on services, officers, boards and commissions are resigning with no professional liability insurance. They don't want to serve on boards and commissions, but it's affecting the services provided to the public. Many of the granted agencies either cannot afford insurance or can't purchase insurance. Municipalities have to offer services unless there's some type of tort reform that's approached by the legislature. It probably will be impossible to afford some type of services. The municipality itself, we've only had one tort claim exceed the retention limit of $500,000 in 10 years. But still, this year, we couldn't purchase insurance for the municipality either, unless it was for a considerable sum, despite our loss record. In the risk management office at the municipality, we received the majority of the tort losses that the municipality have. This involves bike trails, streets, anything that goes on around the city. We look at a different theory of liability every day. Anything that can involve the municipality loss. We look at suits involving design failures, failure to respond, failure to maintain. Even if the municipality or any municipality prevails, it's an expensive proposition. The expense related to claims today sometimes exceeds 40% of the total cost. There is no predictability today for underwriters to measure exposure to some of the judgments entered against some of the public entities around the country. We have to eliminate the deep pocket theory that affects all public entities. The municipality of Anchorage, the number one priority for any public entity at this time is to enact a system of modified comparative negligence by replacing joint and several liability with several liability. I feel it's also very important to put a cap on some type of economic awards for damages. We also are in favor, municipality is, of pooling for small municipalities, although it does not, probably would not affect the municipality bankers itself because of the size. There are no comparable size cities. It might be a difficult arrangement to support a pooling arrangement for the smaller communities, smaller cities. Unless these items that I mentioned, especially the change in the system of modified comparative negligence, unless that's addressed, it will continue to be difficult for municipalities to afford the services that they now have to perform for the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Kelly,
I'd like to ask a question.
Yeah.
One question about Harry, about your pooling arrangements?
Yes.
Could you briefly explain how that would work among smaller municipalities? And would that leave the state at any risk?
Well, they have. They'll ask this, of course, here now. Pooling arrangements, the only conversation that's been out, but perhaps that could be modified. And it's done nationwide now. Some of the pooling arrangements have really worked well. Some have not worked so well, but at least an acceptable alternative. Many of the municipalities nationwide are either uninsured or their limits are reduced to $1 million, so it should be offered as some type of alternative where they could pool their loss information and pay the claims out of a mutual fund arranged between the different entities.
Okay, my concern is I don't want the state all of a sudden becoming the deep pocket, so we wouldn't be liable under these pooling arrangements, correct?
That's why I felt the municipality of Anchorage was doubtful we could be pooling with anybody, but perhaps do you mean by, I suppose it depends on the way the program was arranged, whether or not the state allows it to be held liable for it, depends on the center of the division.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Okay, I have a couple of questions here. Dr. McGuire and Dick Block and Eric Sanders. District, or is that through the municipality?
It's separate from the municipality as far as the municipality. They do have the liability insurance that now, but their members of the data community rely on what the municipality is now.
But they are separate from the municipality?
They're separate from the municipality. Quite separate.
Thank you. Okay, first a comment for Dr. McGuire and for the others. I at least don't intend to study this to death. However, I was in the legislature in 1975-76 when this first came about, and I haven't been studying it for the last 10 years, and I have to be sure in my own mind that what I'm doing is of best public interest, and I think that rules in the legislature. Okay. I was wondering if you could explain to me the differences between paid claims and incurred losses, or paid losses and incurred losses, because that, and how that adds to the incurred or the loss line in your graph.
Okay, well, I can dispose of the graph very quickly by simply saying that this line that I referred to refers to incurred losses. Now, what is an incurred loss? An incurred loss is really a component of, it's really composed of, in the aggregate, of two pieces. First of all, a claim is filed against someone who is insured, and then that claim is presented by the insurer to the insurance company, and the insurance company makes an initial evaluation of what the company believes that case might ultimately cost, if anything. It makes a judgment whether the insured is liable or probably liable, and if so, what the damages might be. And it establishes a reserve, a liability on its books for the amount that it is going to have to pay tomorrow or next week or 2 or 3 years from now, whenever that case is settled. And that is called the case basis reserve, or the case reserve. The reserve set aside, or the liability set aside, for that particular file. And the insurance company has a large liability on its books, which represents the sum of all of those individual file case basis reserves. Okay. And when it sets that reserve, if we say we incur that loss, that is the incurred loss. Now, during the course of the administration of that claim, or the adjustment of that claim, either during the term of the claim or at the end of the claim, an amount is actually paid out, checks are written. And that becomes a paid claim, the time we actually pay it. So what happens is that we incur the loss at the time we find out about the loss. We pay the loss at the time we either settle the case or the court awards a judgment. We're obligated to satisfy that judgment. Those are not cumulative. In other words, if we incur the loss and then later pay the loss, you don't add those together. You pay the loss and then reduce the incurred by the amount you paid. So it's only charged once.
Okay, what percentage of incurred losses are paid out as claims? I mean, one is an incurred loss and the other is the actual claims paid.
Well, unfortunately, Representative Barr, over time, we find that more is being paid out than what was reserved. And There are also situations where you reserve an amount and you probably have not reserved enough.
I'm wondering in the aggregate.
In the aggregate, for the last couple of years, maybe the last 5 or 7 years, what we've been finding is that we've been paying out more, particularly on older cases, than what was originally reserved. And it's forced us to incur more loss in this year, or in a particular year, than what we had incurred in the years in which those losses were reported to us. So, on balance, I have to say we've been paying out more, or finding that we're having to raise our reserves to cover new evaluation of those cases than what was initially reserved.
Thank you. Senator Jarrell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that incurred reserve, how do you determine how much money is to be set aside for a potential claim that maybe you have to be paid?
Liability claim reserve setting is something I guess one learns only by a lot of experience. But we have, as I'm sure all insurance companies have, try to have, are adjusters that have many years of experience in watching the direction in which claim payments go. They know their own files. They know how much they paid out on their own files. They watch what's going on with the court system. They read the Supreme Court opinions. They observe what's reported in the newspaper as settlements. In other cases, the jungle drum within our industry and within affiliated industries communicates what's going on with respect to settlements. And from that, they get a second sense, I guess, as to what a person with an injured back or an injured neck or a broken leg will ultimately get, assuming various kinds of liability. And they kind of have a sense of the direction of the law, and they sort of assume that in an automobile accident, if the guy goes through a red light, he's probably liable, so he's got absolute liability. Not absolute liability, but a fairly certain sense that they're liable and what are the damages. And it's experience and judgment and watching what's going on with the files. And that's how they do it. It is an imprecise science. And in the aggregate, in some cases they're going to come under, in some cases they're going to go over. You try to have it within, say, 5 or 10% in the aggregate.
Just one follow-up, and I'll finish on that. On the same line, though, when you're going through the graphs, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought I heard you use the term the mismanagement of the business. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that as to this was part of the reason there that we were in the situation.
I think collecting less premiums than what you're paying out in losses doesn't reflect sound business judgment in my mind. As a company president, I'm looking to make a profit in the operation of our service business. And, it's not for me to point a finger at any of my other friends in the business, many of whom are no longer presidents of their companies. I think even ask them why that may be. But the fact of the matter is, I regard it as not very smart business to run your business at a loss. And that's what the industry did as a whole. And that's what several components of the industry did as a whole. And now they're trying to recoup for that. And that's going on. I mean, I'm not going to deny that.
Thank you. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was basically the same line of questioning I had. And just one follow-up on that. How's the... I want to make sure I understand this. You predict what reserves you're going to require for future years, and then you are able to base at least in part your rate structure on that prediction. Let me follow it out and you tell me where I'm wrong. And then, of course, you have to... You were at one point the Director of Division of Insurance for the state, so you know the other role, too. You have to take it to the state and convince them that you're also going to need that type of reserve, and then they will approve your new rates. Is that correct?
That's fundamentally correct, yes.
How much difficulty have you been having with the state just getting them to agree with your reserve requirements? Or maybe you aren't the first to ask, but how's the state doing? Is the state doing everything that we should do?
Representative Cotton, I think to answer that question, I must first ask you if it's rhetorically a question, and that is, what do you see as the objectives that the Director of the Division of Insurance should be achieving? If you, again, coming back to my chart, see that the prices which the public are paying for insurance have dropped, even though the losses are going up, has the Director of the Division done a good job or a bad job? From the public standpoint, at least for a period of time, public has gotten a fairly good deal. Now, the plaintiff lawyers have been saying, not today, but in other hearings, that maybe the answer to this crisis is there should have been more rigid rate regulation. The insurance department should have been more rigid about assuring that we had adequacy of rates. That way, there would have been a smooth line up, and the public wouldn't have paid these low prices. There wouldn't have been this differential between unreasonably low prices and the price levels we need now, and therefore, the Division of Insurance has done a poor job. So, how you evaluate that?
Well, it could be, it'd be like the Division of Weights and Measures turning off a gas pump because they're giving more for the money than they should.
That's
that would
issue.
Be an unpopular issue. Right?
That's the issue.
So again, you may not be the appropriate person to ask, how is the state doing?
I think what you should do is ask the consumers. Ask the general contractors. Ask the truckers. Ask the loggers. Ask the air carriers. Ask the daycare centers. Ask these people who are the buyers of the insurance product and all these people in the aggregate, would they rather have paid more in the last 4 to 5 years so that they wouldn't have this bump in prices, or would they have rather paid less then and pay what's necessary now? Ask them. They're the ones that you're supposed to be serving.
As a follow-up to that, what role do you feel that the insurance company should be playing in this crisis? I mean, it seems to me like the only part that they've played is advancing it. I mean, they've raised their premiums. They've attempted, at least it seems, to recoup their losses in 1 year.
Well, they're not going to recoup their losses in 1 year. The loss last year alone was $6 billion to the industry in the aggregate. They're not going to recoup that this year or next year or the next several years, even though they may start making money again. Now, what should be the role of the insurance industry? There are a number of insurance company representatives here that should each define their own role. My perception of what I think our company's role or my role ought to be is to run my business at a profit and in a responsible way so that I can continue to provide the services that we've held out to the public we're going to provide. And secondly, to be able to inform you and the public and those that are interested what's going on and why, and what are the options available to you to do something about it. And that's what I tried to say earlier this morning. I don't have a strong view. I have, as an individual resident of Alaska, I have some views, but as an insurance executive, whether we have a broad interpretation of liability or a narrow, whether we pay $200,000 or $2 million, these are public policy decisions that once you tell us, we'll work within that. I think it's our responsibility to inform you what's going on and why the situation is the way it is and what options are available. I think we've done that very effectively. And beyond that, I think it's our responsibility to operate our business as efficiently, as effectively, as profitably, and as competitively as we can. Because in that way, if you believe in the free enterprise system, if you believe that competition works and generates the kinds of efficiencies and things that work, we'll make money and it will be an efficiently operated system from our standpoint. The one area we cannot control, we can control our expenses, cut down our phone bill, pay less rent, pay less salaries, one thing and another. The area we cannot control, and that's the one that you control, is the amount of money that flows through the system to pay the exposure.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have questions for, I think, just about each of the panel members, and I'd like to start out with Mr. Block. My interest in tort reform is that I think the whole system is a very unfair system. On the one hand, you have an Olympic hopeful who is injured and is fortunately injured by someone who has insurance. And on the other hand, you have an Olympic hopeful who was hit by somebody who doesn't have any insurance, and there's nobody to take the case, and there's no recourse for that victim. So I think the victim, the system as a whole, is quite unfair. What I'm wondering, is there any system or anything that the legislature could implement that would take some of that unevenness out of the system so that can you see, or give me an idea of what a method might be for taking care of this?
Well, Representative Collins, and again, this comes back, I think, to what the legislature establishes as its public policy and objective. If the public policy objective is to see that people who are injured have some economic resource to turn to, separate that from the issue of exacting some punishment or exacting retribution or in some way making a person at fault responsible for it, separate those two things. So the issues of fault and the issues of compensation are separated. Then I think there are things that either the legislature can do or even not do, but still get to the same objective. For example, there are today in place mechanisms that utilize facilities provided by the insurance industry to pay people for most all of their economic loss. Lost wages, medical expense, compensation in the event of death, all of these things, there are insurance policies for it. You can provide to yourself, either directly as an individual or in group programs, with employer groups or association groups or whatever. We all today, most of them, probably 80-85% of us, have available medical insurance and disability insurance and life insurance that pays what we ourselves estimate we are worth or what we might incur as a cost in the event we are injured or killed for one reason or another. And we can define for ourselves what we want our family to have or how much protection we want. And those are in place now. And frankly, if you look at the various insurance mechanisms that are available, those systems, those first-party protection systems, are the most efficient. Measuring efficiency by how much the dollars paid in ultimately get out as benefits, more efficient than any other system there is. And we can take advantage of those. Now, you know, how does the legislature do that? Maybe making it more available or mandating that it be available. I don't like mandating anything, but I mean, if the legislature feels compelled to do it, those are areas deserving of exploration. One thing that is in this bill, incidentally, has been identified with its viability, 532, there is a provision in the bill that goes to that to some degree by saying, let's recognize, in making a liability award, let's recognize the existence of those first-party protections and say that if the injured person has medical insurance and disability insurance and these other components, workers' comp and various things, we'll allow those payments as a credit against the liability award. Now, what does that do? That transfers the cost of reparations, the cost of making this person whole, to a more efficient system and less being paid through an inefficient system. Now, we can argue whether 40% or 35% or whatever percent of dollars paid into the liability system ultimately get to the injured person as a benefit. By the time you pay the legal fees on both sides and all the other costs, it's estimated 35-40% actually reach the injured person. And it's estimated that in these first-party protections, on average, it's closer to 75 or 80%, maybe higher, gets to the injured person. All I'm saying is, there is a way, particularly by using that provision in the proposed bill, that allows the payments to be made by the more efficient system and not get transferred to an inefficient system. Let's take advantage of that. That's one thing that can be done.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question. What you're saying in the sense is that if I have a policy that I have bought for myself that says if I get injured or whatever, that I get $1 million, I get that $1 million fairly soon, hopefully. Is that right? But if I don't have that policy and I sue for $2 million, because of the system, I'm going to get a lot less than $1 million. Is that what you're saying?
By the time the system gets through with it, probably yes. It will take 4 or 5 years before we get it.
Thank you. My next question is for Mr. Sanders. You made a statement that the Rule 82 worked both ways, and I'm wondering how many times in your experience has a plaintiff had to pay for the defense costs?
Well, if you always win your case, you never have to pay that. So I'm not saying I've won all my cases, but cases I've tried. Once I was threatened with that, we dismissed the appeal to avoid paying. Without what I consider to be a valid appeal. But of course, now that never comes up when you've got a settlement. You realize that every time you settle a case related to attorney's fees are not an issue anymore. Only when you try a case are you awarded related to attorney's fees by the court. And only if you try a case and lose as a plaintiff would you be subjected to related to attorney's fees by the court if you lose a plaintiff. Am I making that clear? So, you know, I think that when I was talking to the presiding Superior Court judge a couple months ago, he told me that 96% of all the cases settled. So in 96% of cases related to attorney's fees are not an issue either way.
My next question is for, I believe it was Diane James. In looking at the situation from someone who's been on the losing side of it, I guess I would say, in looking at the system and the way the system has treated you and your family, if there were two or three things that you could think of that would have made that whole experience easier or would have benefited your daughter more, what would they be?
Number one, our system, before you are seriously injured, is that parent gets to pick up the total cost of raising a child. All of a sudden, when someone ages 18 or 19, they become an indigent. Therefore, you have to all of a sudden become a guardian, and you have to account for everything. The whole system, when you talk about an indigent, is really very sad. And you are, not everybody can afford to take out a couple $100,000 hospital and medical field fees in the first 4 years of what could be a long-term 40-year life expectancy. I do not include the cost of what our own personal cost that we have taken out of our own pocket. When the accident occurred, we had to transport her 3,000 miles at our own cost. Air ambulance, flight nurse, medical supplies. I can't begin to tell you how much it cost. She was hospitalized for over a year. And she currently is bedridden, and she lives with us. We elected not to put her in nursing home. I can speak on behalf of what it would cost to put someone in a nursing home for a 40 to 50 year period in the Seattle area and greater in the Seattle area. It would cost approximately $2,000 per month just for nursing home care costs alone. Over a 40 to 50 year period, that amounts to $1,200,000. And that's, let me say, that is only for nursing care costs. It doesn't include medical treatment. It does not include rehab. That does not include the mental anguish and suffering that she has. The fact that she cannot speak and that she can't communicate, and everything from teaching her how to eat, I've had to do, we've had to do, my husband and I have to do. I'm not so much interested in zeroing in necessarily on my daughter's fees, only to illustrate the fact that when a devastating thing like this happens, how the emotional impact, the pain and suffering it has on not only her, but my husband and myself. At least we can go out and walk. I can drive. She can't do anything. And from a person who could dive off the tower with great willingness and dementia, I'm crazy talking. It's really sad. As far as solutions to the problem, we do have a problem. However, our insurance in the state of Washington, for instance, Safeco, in the last quarter, just had a 25% profit. The insurance companies in Washington State have just enjoyed a great profit at the cost of the daycare center, the cost of the truckers. So many people in Washington are starting to form self-insurance companies. Truckers, for instance, cannot do business in the state of Washington without liability insurance. The city of Everett, their liability insurance went up from $68,000 to $400,000. It is a problem that we also deal with.